Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Okay, everybody, welcome to this week's episode. As you probably have noticed in season two, I have really dabbled into, on the fact that we talk a lot about relationships now. And to be honest, several of the episodes really focus on dysfunctional relationships and why many of us have found ourselves in them probably at a chronic level. And as you've heard, those chronic dysfunctional relationships don't always happen by accident. But my listeners do reach out to me and they share with me their emails and their messages about their lives. And it's obvious that we're all in different stages of relationship and life. And we think about this concept of attachment and attachment theory, then it's possible that about half of you out there have a secure partner or already have some sense of a secure view of relationships. And the rest of us have some work to do on that. And so healing from our traumas and our experiences and doing all that work to rewire and understand ourselves is 100% an inside job. But speaking from experience, I've learned that so much more about myself when I started to kind of wade back out into the water of dating. And I've learned more there than I was learning through just therapy alone. So it's important to be able to find ourselves back onto this this pathway of relationships, I think. And so that's why, for me, what I feel like with One Broken Mom, what we're doing first is, for everybody who needs to hear this, is how do we break ourselves away from toxic and abusive and unhealthy relationships that we've been recreating over and over again in our lives? But then instead of leaving us all naked, vulnerable, and defenseless in this world, I want to be able to then show everyone how we build new and healthy ones from that point forward with the right partners. Or how do we strengthen a relationship you may already have with somebody who is journeying and you're on your own growth of self-awareness and healing. And so today I have with me Elizabeth Earnshaw, and she is an individual couples and family therapist and the founder of a practice out in Philadelphia called A Better Life. But she also has this really badass Instagram account that I love called Liz Listens. And so y'all need to follow that. And so I want to welcome Liz to the show today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm so excited to be here and talk with you about all of this stuff.
So cool. So cool. Yeah, me too. So I want to hit this right away. Let's talk about, you know, there's the obvious reasons relationships end because abuse. But why do, in your opinion, why do a lot of relationships actually end that may not be on that spectrum of abusive and toxic situations?
Yeah, so it is the cliche response of communication issues, right? And people come into my office all the time and I say, what's going on? And they say, we have communication issues. And then everybody is like, well, what does that actually mean, right? Because when you get down to it, that means a million different things. But what really happens in relationships that leads them to the end of the relationship is a consistent breakdown of communication over time. And for most relationships, it's something that actually happens fairly slowly. So it's not that it's just happening overnight. There are these small moments in time over and over and over again where we end up missing the mark with the other person. And then we kind of train them how to communicate or not communicate with us. And because of that, we end up having, you know, emotional distance in the relationship, unresolved resentments, inability to solve problems with each other. And those things end up compounding on each other. And eventually they do result in a relationship that ultimately usually ends because of that.
Yeah. And so, you know, and that's, again, I've said this many times before, that's kind of a sad situation to get yourself into, where you're co-grooming each other, you know, basically down to the path of ending if you don't want it. What happens in the dynamic of a relationship where maybe it starts off good, like communication is better in the beginning, but then it devolves over the course of that relationship?
Yeah, so in the beginning of a relationship, human beings for evolutionary purposes are kind of, they're hormonally charged to the point that they actually ignore things that would annoy them in the beginning of a relationship, or not necessarily ignore it. They don't see it. They notice the things that they really like about the other person. They notice the things about the other person that are easy to get along with. And those are the focuses. And because of that, any issue between both people kind of gets put to the side, because you're thinking at that point in time, well, those things don't really matter because all of these things are so good. So I'm just going to focus on how good everything is. And then that stage is called limerence. And once that limerence stage ends, which is a real thing, you're being pumped with hormones, you're being driven to connect with this person for evolutionary purposes, because, you know, as human beings,
it's an adult show. Yeah. It's adult. Yeah.
So we're having sex all the time, hanging out, and everything is perfect about this person, except for all of those little things we know that are not perfect about them, but we put in a closet somewhere. And then what usually happens is some big stressor comes up in the relationship. And that is different for every couple. And it depends on their window of tolerance for stress and all of that. But it could be something like a job change or the birth of a child or a wedding or something tragic like a trauma or a death or something like that. And when that stressor happens, it snaps us out of limerence. And oftentimes it's something minor. It's just something that happens in life. And we are kind of at that point pushed to problem solve with each other. And in that moment, we begin that process of breeding communication. And so if we begin to talk about the problem, the trauma, the difficulty well, then we're likely to continue to reinforce that with each other. But many people, because we're human beings and we're raised to communicate differently than each other, we have that happen. And not only are we shocked about the fact that we're no longer in limerence and this person is no longer perfect and things don't any longer feel perfect, but we're kind of tasked to figure something out that's difficult, and we get into power struggles with each other. And sometimes we resolve those very well by being able to dialogue, come up with solutions. And other times we do things that, like you said, devolve the relationship instead of evolve it. And some of those things look like withdrawing from the issue, criticizing the other person, becoming defensive, protecting our autonomy over protecting the relationship, or being way too focused on the relationship and, kind of because of that, putting our own needs to the side and not paying attention to those things. And so that's kind of the first thing that starts to happen after that, like, perfect period where we think this is just our soulmate and nothing bad's ever going to happen, is something challenging comes up, and then we either address it effectively, which I think is hard for most people, or we get into some sort of power struggle where we're really protecting our own needs on before protecting the needs of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about mentioning this word, the perfect, you know, and the things that we ignore. What do you think some people tend to ignore in those, you know, in that stage of where we're intoxicated and love drunk, with somebody, you know, for example, you know, what are real red flags? And then what are just, you know, inconsistencies that we brush off? Does that make sense? Is that question making sense?
It totally makes sense.
Okay.
It's hard to answer. And I think that's something that a lot of people can get caught up on, is how do I notice a red flag? And there's definitely some very clear red flags that everybody should notice because they aren't healthy. So if somebody is, you know, verbally abusive in the beginning of a relationship, or contemptuous of you or other people, so they like belittle people or they belittle you, huge red flag, right? If they're not forthcoming and you're constantly having to find out that they weren't honest about something, red flag. So there are red flags in terms of like respect and kindness. that I think are across the board important to pay attention to and not put those in the closet. If somebody's not being respectful to you on the first date, they're never going to be respectful to you. I mean, that's just the reality. Like, somebody sits down with you in a restaurant and you order something and they say, "Ew, why would you order that? What's wrong with you?" They're not a respectful person. They're not kind. And so in the very beginning, kindness, respect, look for those. And if they're not there, it's not even necessary that you have to address it with the person. It might just be necessary that you address it with yourself and figure out that maybe this isn't the right relationship. Mm-hmm. However, I think most of the red flags, which are those things that 5 years later we look back and said, "Oh, I saw that and I should have paid attention to it and I regret that," they vary by person and they vary by relationship. And they're often things that come out of, they're often the things that we lacked in childhood. And this partner, in some ways, is giving us the stuff that we really liked in childhood up front. So if we really liked the way that our parents had a great sense of humor or something like that, we're on this first date, we're noticing that this person has a great sense of humor. We're noticing that they're really kind, like our parents were, or really hard workers. And because that's comfortable, we say, "This person is perfect for me because they're all the good things that I grew up with." And then we start to notice that they have some of the bad things that we grew up with too. But we don't want to believe that that pattern is happening again. And so that can be different for every single person. For some people, that might mean that, maybe they had parents who were really emotionally distant. And they kind of notice it. You know, they say something vulnerable and the partner, that the first date or whatever, doesn't really respond emotionally, but they ignore it. And part of them says, "I'm ignoring it because that's normal and comfortable because that's what I grew up with." And part of them says, "I'm ignoring it because I don't want to believe this is happening to me again, because that already happened to me for 20 years of my life or whatever." And so I think sometimes we can get caught up on making a list of red flags, and then we go on these dates and we think that there's going to be surface level red flags. And really the red flags are often much deeper than that. And so I like how you said, I don't like to make people raw and vulnerable and then not give them information about, like, what do you do with it? So it's like, what do you do with the fact that there's not an easy list of red flags beyond abuse? And what you have to do is you have to really sit down with yourself and come up with a list of what were my major disappointments from my initial attachment figures, from the people who were supposed to keep me safe. And am I willing to hold myself accountable to the fact that I'm likely going to be most attracted to the people that will still disappoint me in the same way, because it feels normal? And what do I do in those circumstances? And what you do is you try to address it with the person. And that doesn't have to be something that's awkward. Like, "I notice that you're emotionally distant. My dad is emotionally distant. What are you going to do for me?" But what it can look like is saying, "Hey, you know, I've noticed that when I bring up things that are vulnerable, you don't seem to respond. And it's really important to me to get emotional responses back. Is that something you can do?" And in doing that, you're giving them an opportunity to really show you whether or not they're going to disappoint you again, continue to disappoint you, or if they're going to be willing to work towards meeting you where you need them to be. And that's really how you don't put things in the closet, is that you know what you were disappointed about in the past, you know you're going to be attracted to that again, and then you're willing to talk about it.
Yeah. And I'm that's an awesome answer. I mean, like, and I'm sitting here nodding for the people that are listening. My head is going bouncing back and forth. Because, you know, I think that is one of the biggest things that I got out of the dating process, was the testing the waters, you know, pushing something out there, feeling in myself what kind of response I was getting. And, you know, and I had to sit here and resolve with me, like, you know, that whole concept of attraction, of like, what type of a personality and posturing am I most comfortable with and why? And, you know, and I had bucketed in the past those people into, well, gosh, if they're these things, like these four characteristics, you know, unfortunately, they're probably going to be the other eight that I hate or that are abusive. But then I realized, like, that's not always the case. So what is it, like, dig down? What is it that I really, you know,
what do I need to connect with me? And can somebody, for example, that might be, you know, not as emotionally, you know, just out there, can they still be comforting and safe and things like that? And what I found was, is that for me, fear has always been my biggest block with communication. And that is being scared to say something that I want, which is obviously a trauma response, right? You learn that you can't be as open without there being a consequence to that. Like saying, hey, I'm unhappy right now, and having a parent come back and go, you have no right to be unhappy, or, you know, I don't have time for your unhappiness. My needs are more important right there. And so you learn to kind of channel that all back inside of yourself. And what I've done with, you know, through this relationship building process and dating process is push through that fear. Because what I've noticed, as you said there, that what I need is I need to know that I can do that with somebody. And then I have to kind of shore myself up for the possible rejection, you know, and if that's rejection comes, that's my, that won't work. Like there's, you know, this isn't going to move forward for me. Or do I have somebody here on the other end that goes, I hear you, I see you, like, you know, thanks for sharing that with me. And then they can either in turn be vulnerable back or not. And that is scary, that, you know, to say that, you know, the block is fear, you know, most of the time to communicating. Is that something that you see with the couples that you work with, that, you know, when it gets down to the brass tacks, the thing that's stopping each other from talking with one another, is they're afraid of what the other person has to say to them?
Yeah, they're afraid. And I think they're afraid and for many different things. Sometimes it's, what is the person going to say? Sometimes it's, what am I going to say? I'm not good at talking, and I'm not going to state this well. But I think you hit the nail on the head, that fear is really what prevents people, whether they're just dating or they are in a long-term committed relationship. It prevents people from being really honest with each other, communicating well. And it also prevents opportunity for the other person to be successful, or for you to really see who the other person is. And so, you know, what it ends up doing is it ends up creating kind of fog in the relationship, where it's, I'm just going to be behind this fear, and I'm going to grip on and close my eyes, and I really hope this works out without me having to say anything. And then what happens is that you don't say anything, but then over time, usually the feared response ultimately happens, which is you end up not getting what you want from this person.
Yeah. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, unfortunately, in relationship, right? You know, part of your fear is they're going to reject me. And then when you're unable to communicate your needs or listen to their needs, well, you get what you were afraid of, you know, which is sad, you know, honestly. Now, I know fear can block us from communicating, but what does fear look like typically when it's coming back to us in a response? How do we recognize that maybe our partner's response is actually a fear-based response versus, I know, for example, is sometimes depression looks like anger. It doesn't look like sadness, you know? So when somebody says something to their partner and their partner responds back in a certain way, how do you know, as the therapist working with them, that like that person's actually responding to you out of fear as well? Because I feel like if we all know that we're scared, we open ourselves up, I think, a little bit to be more kinder, you know, with one another, especially if we're trying to work through problems and struggles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's such a good question. And I love that there's also in this question a focus on the other person's experience as well, because I think a lot of times we are hyper focused on our experience and then judgmental of their response, and we're willing to say, I was afraid, that's why I responded defensively, or I was afraid and that's why I wasn't forthcoming with what I had to say. And then we're very often unwilling to say that about the other person. And we're likely to say they're just a liar, or they're just distant, or whatever. And I think, you know, it can be difficult sometimes in that initial response to know that it's from fear, right? Because you might just take it at face value. But I love this idea of how can we look at what they're doing and their responses from like a place of compassion, and assuming that maybe it is coming from fear. And if you do that, then how do you change the responses to them? And so if you bring up something that's really important to you and they respond in a way that you like to hear, that could still be a fear response. Mm-hmm. They could just be telling you what you want to hear because they have their own trauma history of not being able to really say what they mean. You could say something that's important to you and they might respond with defensiveness. Also, that's from a space of fear. The fear is you're seeing me as less than, I feel inadequate, and I'm defending myself. They might respond from a place of distancing from you. And that might look like just not responding or saying, let's not talk about this. This is a silly conversation, or changing the subject. And I think that it's challenging to know, how do I respond to these things? And how do I know whether or not this person who's distancing from me or being defensive or perhaps people pleasing me is someone that can eventually have an authentic relationship with me? And part of that is noticing that, is always checking in and seeing, how are you feeling about the way we're communicating with this? And I think that we don't do that enough. So if you ask somebody something and they become defensive, instead of shutting down, saying, hey, babe, I noticed that you seem like you're defending yourself right now. And I'm on your side. I'm not trying to criticize you. I'm not trying to be hurtful to you. I really want to make sure that we're both meeting each other's needs. Is something going on here that's making you feel afraid or like I'm judging you, or what's happening here? And just pointing that out and allowing that other person to share with you what their experience is. The same with if you start to notice that they just appease you with their answers. Again, probably comes out of some sort of fear. And you might say something like, I notice that when I bring this up, you often say, you know, you often tell me things that feel good to me, but then it doesn't actually happen later on down the road. And so I'm wondering, are you just telling me these things because you're afraid to tell me something different? And really just continually checking in with each other when you notice that there might be an issue with how they're communicating with you is really the most you can do. And then that person gets to decide, are they honest with you? Do they tell you, yes, I'm afraid. Yes, I was nervous. Yes, I felt criticized. Yes, I'm just people pleasing you. Are they willing to be vulnerable? Or are they not in that place in their lives yet? And do they just continue to people please, continue to be defensive and all of those things? Again, you use all of these moments as opportunities to decide how ready this person is to be in a relationship with you.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you brought that up because that's, you know, it feels like sometimes with couples therapy, it's like the last salvo, like it's the, we're down and out and somebody makes the decision on behalf of the relationship that we are going to therapy to fix this. And that, you know, it's not always two willing participants that come into it. And I've also seen this with, you know, with other folks too, which is, I call it this unevenness, you know, that can happen in a relationship where one person is really focusing on themselves. Like they're like, you know, they're coming into, for example, they're landing on my show because they're like, hey, I recognize that there's some of these things that I really have an opportunity to grow and heal from. And it's not easy to do that work. And so they start making that personal investment in them. But then they've got this other person over here who may be 100% supportive of all the work that's going on. But they're not doing their own work. And as we know, you know, when somebody really starts to unravel and heal and put pieces back together in their own lives, that you can really start to grow apart from each other really pretty quickly. And is there, you know, does that mean the relationship has to end if one person is doing this? Or is there a way that when you're counseling with a couple, can they still continue on as a couple together if it's, you know, this imbalance begins to happen?
Yeah, so nothing is ever always, right? Right. So there are many people that choose to be in imbalanced relationships, but I love how you're calling these uneven relationships. I've never thought of them that way before, but it happens all the time. I would say 90%, I'm making this statistic up, but 90% of the couples that I see in my office are that. Where one person is coming in and they're saying, I've had some sort of revelation. I've been reading books. I've been listening to a podcast. I followed you on Instagram and it made me think things. And I really want us to get on the same page with the stuff that I'm learning about relationships and myself. And the other person will be like, all right, well, I'm here, aren't I? And, you know, it's disheartening to see, because the one partner is saying, I'm really making a bid for connection with you here. I want you to read the book too. I want you to listen to the podcast also. I want you to go to therapy so that you can take responsibility for your half, because I feel like I'm growing and I'm evolving and I'm taking responsibility, and the other person isn't always there. There are multiple outcomes to that. Sometimes we talk about it and the other person does come to their own revelation through the conversation. They're able to, through a third party, think, you know what, you're right. There are some things that don't feel right in my life, or that book sounds beneficial, or just this therapy is my version of working on myself. And then it becomes a little bit more even. When that doesn't happen, I think it's really hard for a couple to stay together and feel fulfilled. Mm-hmm. They might stay together. But I think it's really challenging, because what happens is that one person grows beyond the other person emotionally or spiritually. And because of that, you begin to have more opportunities for affairs. You begin to have less opportunity for connection, because what are you connecting on if one of you is learning and thinking about totally different subjects than the other person? You even the person that grows might actually start to look down on the other person. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is it's usually that person that will end up leaving a relationship. It's mm-hmm. not the other person who's not growing. The other person is kind of like, this is fine. And this person who's been reading and trying to learn, they've been probably miserable for a little while. And mm-hmm. so they're trying to fix it. And then through that growth process, if somebody doesn't become their partner in that, they often do end up leaving the relationship in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to myself that, you know, being supportive is great, you know, about another person wanting to grow and change themselves. But I feel like that I personally, you know, I'm a little demanding, because I've invested in myself. And when I see somebody who has a minefield out in front of them of these unknown, you know, factors in their life, because they don't want to find those, you know, I get a little sick of walking through their minefield, you know, when I know that, you know, some of that stuff, and I know that sounds, it can kind of come off as insensitive, but I also feel like, you know, part of growing is valuing yourself, you know, and your experiences, and that there is a point of where you just kind of go, I just don't think that I can continue to look past all of this opportunity. And, you know, and I feel like too, sometimes maybe a partner who is on the growth thing, like you said, like we want the other person to come with us. And I've been that person where I have overinvested in the attempts to change my partner to meet me where I'm at, and spent way too much time doing that before my own growth taught me, you don't do that for somebody else. Like you can't do that. You can lay all the breadcrumbs down, but they ultimately have to make the choice to follow those. You know, so how often when you're working with couples, are you counseling them to a conclusion that's the most compassionate, you know, next step, not to save and continue on with the relationship?
Yeah. So it happens frequently. And I think that sometimes people think that's a failure, and really it's not. A really good couples therapist is there to save the relationship. And what that means is that it might end sometimes. Saving the relationship doesn't mean staying together. Saving the relationship means that you protect both individuals from further harm, and that you protect the actual relationship from further harm. And so sometimes when we're talking and when we're working through things, and when everybody's put a really good faith effort as far as they personally can, and the relationship's still not clicking, sometimes the most compassionate way of looking at it is, how do we release each other? And how do we keep as much integrity in this relationship as we can as it is? Because the alternative to that is forcing something that's causing harm, And when something causes harm, it's just going to keep causing more harm that's likely to get worse over time. And harm doesn't always look like abuse. Harm also looks like loneliness and neglect. And so it's not the ideal, of course. People get together and they want to stay together. And if they're in couples therapy, there's something important enough there that they've decided it's worth trying to salvage. But as many people as figure out the issues and work through them together, there are other people who don't. And that's okay. And that's not a failure. And I think it's so important that we remove that idea that ending a relationship, ending a marriage, whatever it is a failure. Because really, if you do it well, if you do it consciously, if you're choosing it because it's the healthiest thing, then it's a success.
Actually, yeah. And you might be able to maintain friendship, co-parenting, you know, a variety of positive outcomes from that if it's actually done well and consciously, you know, with everybody that's involved. Now, I wanted to talk about communication for couples that are, you know, in the heat of the moment right now. And one of the things that I think it's important about your practice is that you use the Gottman method in couples therapy. And I will put you, like, you know, on my wish list as Dr. John Gottman because of the work, you know, the extensive work, decades of it, and studying and understanding couples. What is particularly important about this methodology and applying it to therapy and applying it to communication that may be different than what most of us are used to, maybe what we saw our parents talking or not talking to each other that we've had modeled to us in our life? You know, help me understand where this method is and this methodology and why is it powerful for couples to know about and pick up on?
It's so powerful for a couple of reasons. One is because I think it gives couples a blueprint for how to be successful. And prior to having that type of blueprint, we are just doing exactly what we saw. And we're kind of just shooting darts with a blindfold on, hoping to hit the bullseye. But we're replicating behaviors that we saw completely unconsciously. And so once you understand the research behind communication and relationships that John Gottman did, you have a blueprint for how to say things, for how to receive things, for how to work through problems. And most people just don't have that. We're just coming into one of the most important things we do in our lives, which is relationships, with zero training. You know, we wouldn't do that with anything else. Like anything else that's important in our lives, we get licenses for, we go to classes for, we have to take trainings. We get married, or we move in together. And it is one of the most important things we'll ever do because the way that we treat other human beings deeply impacts them. You know, we can heal other people and we can harm other people in the way that we communicate. And so the Gottman method really helps people to have that training around what is going to be a really effective way to maintain a listener and to not lose a listener. And what's a really effective way to make your partner feel loved and understood? And one of the biggest differences between the Gottman work and then maybe other ways of looking at communication and relationships is that it's actually based in research. So the Gottman Institute over decades has researched thousands of couples and really pinpointed some very easy communication shifts that takes couples away from the possibility of their relationship ending and towards a relationship that is likely to last in a fulfilling way, not just because you're making it last, just mm-hmm. to last. And it's really only a few things. And I think that's the coolest part is it's not overwhelming to learn about those things. And they're easy shifts. And I'm not saying that they're easy in terms of it's not going to take mental work and practice, but they're easy to remember. And so you can consistently remind yourself, I need to do this thing. And if I do this thing, I'm more likely to be a good partner. I'm more likely to help this relationship to grow. And so I think that those are the really important parts of it do you want me to share a little bit?
Yeah, I was going to say, let's give the listeners a sample of what that is, because I'm sitting here thinking, some couples, and it may be just be one partner listening to the show who's like, oh, I really would like to improve this, but how do I come to my partner with this whole idea of shifting communication and not having it feel clumsy or, having it like land like a lead balloon because it's so big, like, hey, we're going to do worksheets every day. Like that's just not going to work. Right. But I think if you can provide an example of what the subtlety might be that can actually be pretty profound, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. So in terms of conflict, I'll give a few examples, and then there's some stuff outside of conflict too. But like you said, it's not just saying something really big, like we need to be more emotionally connected and let's start working on that every day.
Right.
But you want to work on avoiding four things. And so if you go to your partner and you say, hey, babe, the great thing about this is it's not about making anybody wrong. It's about saying, hey, babe, I listened to this podcast or I read this book. And research shows that couples do better when they avoid these four things. And I'm not saying you do it or I do it, but I'm saying I'd like us to pay attention. And the first thing is criticism. And we really want to avoid criticizing other people when we have an issue. And we want to make sure that we remember that the problem is a problem. The problem is not a problem with your partner. And remembering that helps you to bring up the issue more gently. And bringing up the issue more gently isn't putting like a bow on a bag of shit, right? It's not saying like, oh, we're just going to pretend like this isn't existing. But there's ways that you can express anger and frustration and that you can say somebody's really disappointing you without criticizing them. And what that looks like is it's owning the problem as your own. The example I always give is messy dishes in the sink, right? So I come home after work and I work late. It's 10 p.m. and there's dishes in the sink. If I start that conversation, if I walk in my house and I say, you always leave the kitchen like this, I have then not made the dishes the problem. My partner's the problem. He's the always issue. He's the reason I'm pissed off every night. But if I walk in and I say, what is going on with these dishes? I am so tired and I really need us to figure out what we're going to do about the dishes. Otherwise, I'm just miserable at night. My partner is more likely to say, you're right, they're a wreck, or I'm really sorry about that, I should have gotten to them, or we need to figure out a solution. And so you want to try to avoid criticism and replace it with stating what your need is, not stating what their problem is. And that's an easy shift. And you're not going to do it perfectly, but the great news is if you talk to your partner about practicing this stuff, you can fix it. So you can say, honey, I'm so sorry. I just walked in the house and I criticized you. Let me try that again because we're practicing this. And that will give you an opportunity to try to state these things in a way. And I always say it's a way to make the other person successful for you. Mm-hmm. No one is ever successful for you when you criticize them. They just go into themselves and they keep you out. People can be successful for you if you tell them you have a problem and if you tell them it's impacting you. Again, like the rest of this call, if they aren't, it tells you something about the relationship and you get to decide what you do with that. The second thing you really want to look out for is defensiveness. And usually defensiveness and criticism go hand in hand. I walk in, I criticize my husband. My husband is going to say back to me, what are you talking about? You had as much time to do the dishes as I did. Or you don't understand, I was so busy. Or why are you always so mean to me? And that gets us nowhere. So instead of defensiveness, you want to replace that with taking responsibility for even the smallest part of the issue you can take responsibility for. So while you're practicing this, your imperfect partner who you love might criticize you. And what you're going to do instead of being defensive because you want to have communication integrity is you're going to say back, babe, I felt kind of criticized. And at the same time, you're right. The dishes are horrible. We have to figure out a solution. Again, this is another opportunity. You just stop that conflict cycle dead in its tracks because then your partner is likely to say, oh, I'm sorry I criticized you. Thank you for understanding. The third shift you want to make is that you don't want to do something called stonewalling. Stonewalling is what it sounds like. It's when you become a stone wall. So you're really withdrawn from your partner. They are trying to communicate something with you. They are maybe talking about a problem, and it overwhelms you so much that you cut off. And you either cut off just physically, you go blank, you kind of cross your arms, you turn away, or you actually leave the conversation and you say, I'm not talking about this anymore. And if you notice yourself doing that, you want to get really good at letting the other person know what's going on for you. Saying something like, I can tell, you know, you probably notice I'm not listening right now. It's because I feel overwhelmed with what you're saying. I just need to take 20. And you can just start doing that. That's okay. You can get overwhelmed. You can take a break. But what is not effective is if you take a break with the person still talking and they don't know you're taking a break. So you can't decide you've taken a break from the conversation and not let the other person know, because then what they see is they think you don't care.
Right. And can I, you know, and I, because I like that part there too, that's something, and I'm thinking to myself too, as listening, obviously these are tactics that work with kids, especially teenagers, and we apply that. But I know with the stonewalling part is the difficulty with asserting that, like, I need a break. Like, I'm getting to that place. And I see this in my daughter, and my daughter and I do this to each other where it's like, okay, we need to hit a timeout. It's important though for the partner to respect that. I think of it as like a safe word. Like, once you sit there and say, I'm at that point where I'm emotionally driven up and I can't do this right now, that other partner needs to also say, got it. Good. Like, let's not push it, because sometimes we keep pushing the problem, right? We push ourselves past an intelligent conversation right down into the depths of screaming and yelling and crying and, you know, all the emotional parts where we know nothing gets done, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I know you had, I listened to the other podcast where like attachment styles were being discussed and mm-hmm. stuff. And if people are interested in conceptualizing things that way, the stonewalling person is being avoidant in that moment. And usually the person discussing the problem is being more anxious. Mm-hmm. And so when the stonewaller says, I need a break, they're actually doing a really great job of not being avoidant. They're being clear and direct with you. And so for the person who's feeling anxious, it's really their job to figure out, how do I self-soothe while they're soothing their anxieties? Because the alternative is chasing people around the house, following them, sending 800 text messages, saying, no, don't leave this room or I'm going to end this relationship. And that never gets us anywhere. We've all done it. You know, I'm guilty. I've done it. I've told my husband, no, you're not leaving this conversation.
Right. We're solving it right now.
Now. And leave, then like, F that. I'm not going to deal with this anymore. It never works. The other person just gets more flooded. They withdraw more. And so in the case of stonewalling, there's a responsibility for both people to self-soothe. The difficult part is their soothing looks different. The person who is flooded, their soothing has to help them to become more activated. They need to take a break so they can talk. The person who's anxious, they need to take a break so that they stop talking. And so when both people give permission for that, they can come back to a place that feels a lot more regulated and a lot more productive.
Good. Okay. I'm glad you got to that part there. Cause like I said, I feel like, it is, even in the stonewalling, it's still a two-way street here, you know, that needs to be recognized. Okay. So then the fourth, you were going to talk about the fourth thing that we need mm-hmm. to be mindful of.
So the fourth thing to be mindful of is contempt, and contempt is the most dangerous of all of them. And when contempt is showing up in a relationship, it's likely that there are really unhealed resentments. It's kind of a form of punishment. And if it's not because of unhealed resentments, it's because whoever's showing the contempt has an experience of people being disrespectful in order to get their point across. And so perhaps when they were growing up, they had parents who also used contempt and were also disrespectful when in conflict. And so it could also just be a pattern. But contempt is criticism supercharged. It is no longer just that your partner never does the dishes. It's that your partner is less than you because they're an idiot that never learned how to do the dishes. And so there's a shift there. It goes from, I'm annoyed with you because you never help around the house, to what's wrong with your mother? Didn't she ever teach you how to do this? There's disgust from it. There's not just anger, there's disgust. And when you start expressing disgust towards your partner, you're taking a role of superiority. And you can't have an effective partnership if one person believes that they're superior to the other. And in the worst cases, it becomes abusive, right? It becomes verbally abusive or physically abusive because you believe you're better than this person and you're willing to cross a line into total disrespect. In the average cases, it just becomes really mean. And it doesn't just, it's not just words, it's also eye rolling. It's snickering when they say they have a problem. It's being sarcastic at the expense of the other person. When you're working through contempt, or if you notice it, if you notice it in yourself, it's really important to step back and say, am I showing contempt because there's an unhealed resentment? You know, was there an affair? Did somebody spend money they weren't supposed to spend? After I had a baby, was my partner not there for me in the way I had hoped they would be? And now I'm just so angry with them that they disgust me. If that's the case, you have to be able to tap into that resentment and be vulnerable with it and ask your partner to do what they need to do to make it up to you. Because your contempt is never going to heal that. But if you can say, I've said some awful things to you and there's no excuse for it. And I think it's because I have a lot of unhealed wounds. We need to work on those together. Then that is a path forward. And again, two-way street, your partner then has to receive that and be willing to work on it. If you find that your contempt is based off of childhood communication patterns, so you witnessed abusive communication growing up, then it's really important that you do the internal work to begin to shift that stuff. And one thing that I think really helps people to come into connection with that is next time you show contempt and you notice it, ask yourself, who did this to me? Who talked to me this way? Who rolled their eyes at me? Who sneered at me? And think back to a time that you noticed somebody do that to you. And in that moment, notice and remember what that felt like. Because as soon as you can begin to connect to how badly it feels for someone to be contemptuous to you, you can start to have empathy for your partner. And returning to empathy is the antidote of contempt. Once you have empathy, you don't have contempt anymore.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, because you end up with that icky feeling inside of you of like, oh, yeah, no, that was pretty bad. Where does, you know, we talk about like the contempt and stonewalling then kind of brings in a painful tactic that some people use that goes from just being avoidant, you know, emotionally phobic to abusive, which is the silent treatment, which is probably one of the, you know, it is to me an extremely insidious abuse attack tactic that doesn't seem like it is, but the shutting down and refusing to talk, acknowledge, experience anything with your partner. And I've had a partner do this to me for, you know, for days of no talk and then never being able to come back into the conversation again. I mean, where's the line between stonewalling and I need a break to I'm just avoiding all of this and now I'm going to punish you by not talking to you? Because that seems like a pretty unhealthy communication tactic for partners to use, especially if you have a partner or you do that yourself.
Yeah. And I really like that you brought that up because that is so important. And a lot of these things, the question is, where is the line? Where is the line between I'm a human being trying to learn how to communicate better and I'm really doing this in an abusive way? And the stonewalling, the thing is that someone who's effectively managing it, they come back to the conversation. It really should only take 20 to 30 minutes to calm down to a place where you can re-engage with your thought processing and come back to a conversation. In a particularly difficult scenario, maybe you want to take the evening. Maybe you want to take 2 days. But the stonewaller is always responsible for returning to the conversation and starting it. And so it's okay for somebody to take a break as long as you can rely on them to re-engage. So if you stonewall, it's really important that you say, I can't talk about this. I need to sleep, but I will bring this up tomorrow, and that you really do bring it up. If you are in a relationship with someone who stonewalls, you want to see that there's a pattern on them being able to calm down, because it really is a physical response when someone stonewalls. Their heart is actually beating at 100 beats per minute. They can't talk to you. You want to let them calm down. And you also want to pay attention to whether or not they're willing to come back to the conversation and engage in it. Stonewalling and taking breaks doesn't come from a place of punishment. It comes from a place of wanting to save the relationship. And so you're doing the relationship a favor. In healthy relationships, there's no room for punishment. So if you're doing things to punish your partner, including distancing from them, then you're doing something that is really detrimental and harmful to the relationship and can be abusive. And so if you notice yourself saying things like, I don't want to talk to them because they don't deserve it, or this will teach them, this will teach her, or this will teach him to not talk to me that way, you're punishing. Mm-hmm. And when a relationship moves into a power struggle that's based in punishment, then it's only going to devolve unless the person who's punishing is willing to actually be vulnerable and to come back and say, I'm really angry with you. And I always tell people, call the elephant out in the room. Tell the person, I was punishing you. You don't have to pretend like you weren't. Come back and say, I've been punishing you for 2 weeks because I was so mad at you. And I know that's going to kill our relationship. I don't want to punish you anymore, but I'm mad. And I need you to hear how mad I am. And I'm actually going to talk about that. But it always has to be about a return to connection.
And again, I'm sitting here thinking, like, we're talking about couples and romantic personal relationships, but, you know, the way we also engage with our kids, and I always tell everybody, you know, with one broken mom, no children are required. But for anybody that's listening that has children, I mean, what you're bringing up is if you also do that with your own kids, that's the communication style you're teaching them that they're then taking into relationships, you know, when they move forward and being mindful of it. And I think that sometimes an adult makes a switch where they might not punish their friends. They might not punish their romantic partner, but they feel it's their obligation to punish their children. Like that's what parenting looks like. And so I want, you know, my own 2 cents on this for anybody that's listening to this is think about everything that Liz just went through and think about, do you talk to your kids that way? You know, maybe you're thinking about taking this to your husband or wife or your partner to do that. But if you have kids, check yourself and make sure that you're also extending it to them just to give them a chance, dear God, at having a healthier relationship as they move into that phase of their life than what we have to heal from and, you know, and make up for, you know, at this point in time.
Yeah. Okay. And you know, I think that sometimes people think their punishment is what teaches their children. Mm-hmm. Punishment doesn't teach anybody anything other than how to shut up and be ashamed and hide away, mm-hmm. Or how to be nasty in their other relationships. That's really the only thing punishment does. And again, this isn't, we all punish sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's just human nature. The thing that teaches your children the most is the way that you act. So if you want your children to speak respectfully, really pay attention to whether or not you're being respectful, not only towards them, but around them. You know, are you having respectful conversations with the adults in their lives? And that's not always easy, but we teach the most by the way we behave, by the way we work through things with our kids, instead of by the way we punish, either by emotionally cutting them off or by making them feel badly or whatever it is. Like those things don't actually cause internal shifts in their behavior. They just make them feel really badly emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I, you know, and flip this back to your partner, right? So you are working on yourself and you're trying to improve, you know, your own well-being here. And they might be at that state of unevenness. Maybe it's in the early stages. You modeling what it is you'd like for them to give to you by you giving it to them can help them understand and grow and learn from that as well. Like, okay, so you demanding it from another person wouldn't be as effective as, okay, I know that, you know, you think internally, I know that they're not quite as, you know,
up to speed on how to do this in reciprocity with me. But that doesn't mean I'm going to quit doing it for them, because eventually they might be able to see what that looks like and what that feels like to receive your grace, your understanding, your communication, you know, you avoiding or apologizing for when you do make a mistake and coming back and trying to reinforce it, and patience, you know, modeling what patience looks for, like for them. Cool. Now I want to find out, you live in the Philly area. Is that the only way people get to work with you, or do you have other resources besides your, again, your awesome Instagram account where people can connect with your wisdom and your ability to be able to help other folks, and particularly couples?
Yes. So I only work with therapy clients in Pennsylvania because of licensing laws. Mm-hmm. However, I do have courses that people can take. You can find them if you find my Instagram account. It's at Liz Listens, and you can just click the link and it'll take you to them. I have a course that has, it's called the Foundational Relationship Skills, and it has really all of the information essentially that I learned as a couples therapist distilled for you, so that you know what these minor shifts are that you can make that really, really change communication, change intimacy, change connection, increase the likelihood that you can maintain a healthy relationship. So that's one way you can work with me. I also sometimes host webinars, you know, I'm on podcasts, and I give tons of free stuff away on my Instagram and then also through my newsletter. So I sometimes do free webinars or send free worksheets or whatever. So there are a lot of different ways that you can work with me.
Cool. And all the links will be in the podcast notes, as everybody knows. So you'll be able to find her that way and be able to get, you know, resource to all this great stuff. We talk a little bit about repairing and saving relationships, but really, should anybody wait until the end, until, like, you know, they're bleeding out on the floor to go see the doctor? Or really, you know, should our shifts in our mindset, especially around mental health and mental wellness, should we be considering engaging in therapy, not for the sake of fixing something that's broken, but in terms of just improving the health of a relationship earlier in a relationship?
Yes. And that is something I'm so passionate about shifting, in our world and in the way that we see mental health. For some reason, mental health has been viewed as something that you do at the end of the line. Something right. You do when you're already incredibly depressed. Something you do when you're already about to get a divorce. Something you do after the affair. I mean, and it's really important to do it at those times, just like going to the doctor if you're bleeding. And at the same time, we go for regular checkups to dentists. We go for regular checkups to doctors. And there doesn't have to be anything wrong to go. We just go to make sure that everything's okay. And I think a huge way to prevent relationship distress or even personal distress is to go in when you feel good. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean you have to make a commitment. You don't need to go every week if you feel good. But every now and then, do something for your relationship or for your mental health during times that you feel good, whether that's taking courses or seeing a therapist or reading books. Take care of yourself in those moments where everything's okay. When I work with my clients, one of the things I say to them, they come in and they'll say, I had a good week. I actually don't have anything to talk about. And I tell them, this is my favorite week to see you then, because this is the week we get to plan for what you'll do if you have a bad week again. This is actually how we prevent fallout. This is how we prevent it from feeling really bad. So this is my favorite week to talk to you. And for anybody listening, even if you're in a good moment in your life, if you go see a therapist, they'll be so happy to talk to you, because it's a way for you to figure out, how do I keep this going?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then even for couples, you know, being able to shift for any of the ones, you know, that are newly getting married, and, you know, how do you set up this groundwork, this emotional contract with one another about how you're going to be communicating early on is, I think, really important. And again, it's not a common shift for people to think. I mean, sometimes people do their pre-marriage counseling and it's a couple of sessions, maybe with the officiant that's going to do it. And they just kind of say, you know, here's what life is like, or, you know, mom and dad throw down some, you know, wisdom there. But, you know, we haven't gotten, I don't think yet, where people like really step into the early days of the relationship and start to talk about before we have the problems. How are we going to do this as a team together? What are we going to do to protect ourselves, you know, our relationship from these things? Because life is an imperfect process, and that's what's amazing about it. And as opposed to, like you said, wait until you absolutely need it and you're just trying to save it. You know, it's like, can we nurture it, you know, early on? And it sounds like the programs that you have and some of the courses, you know, I highly encourage, don't be taking them because you're in a bad place. Take them because you're in a great place. And this is a wonderful time to introduce this for you and your partner to start looking at ways of just enhancing, you know, your lives together. So,
yeah.
Cool. Well, Liz, it's been a pleasure meeting you and talking to you. Like I said, I've been a huge fan of your Instagram account and everything that you do. And so it's an honor to have been able to spend an hour with you today and talk about this and, you know, and how couples can actually work on improving communication. And hopefully people are going to take away something from this that helps them if they're still in the stages of finding a new relationship, you know, how they get to go in, you know, strong foot forward with a new person right from day one. So I appreciate your time so much.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm so honored. I love your podcast. I have it on subscription. And so when I turn on my car, it pops on. And sometimes it's like the episode I already listened to because it just like auto goes back. But I love it. So I'm just so honored to be here. And it was so cool to see you and be able to talk to you. And I really enjoyed it.
Cool. Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quiracone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.